Welcome to First Fuel, a podcast bringing perspectives on the role of energy efficiency, energy management, demand response, and the energy transition taking place in Australia and around the world. I'm Luke Menzel, CEO of the Energy Efficiency Council, and this week I'm joined by Heidi Lee. Heidi is CEO of Beyond Zero Emissions, an independent think tank that devotes its time to creating solutions for a prosperous net zero Australia. Heidi, hello and welcome to the podcast.
I'm so happy to be here, Luke. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, it's great to have you along. And not before time, I think you've been in that seat as the CEO of BZE. Am I right in saying about a year now?
We're coming up to a year, a few more months until an official 12 months. But yes, it has been a fantastic journey in this chair. But I've been involved in BZE for around 10 years before taking this role on. And a sign that I've enjoyed every part of that journey.
Yeah, I believe as a board member and also as a member of the management team there, and now as the CEO. It's an important organisation, plays a really important role in the debate, but not everybody that is listening to the podcast will be familiar with BZD. So you're probably very well placed, given that long association, to give us a little bit of a potted history of BZD, you know, what its origins were and what role it currently plays.
Like you say, we're an independent think tank, so we're not attached to a university or a political party. We do our own work. Yep. We started around a kitchen table with a bunch of engineers sitting down and rolling up their sleeves about probably 15 years ago now, and deciding to answer for themselves the pressing question of the time, which was, can technology actually deliver a 100% renewable energy grid? Mm. So these engineers set themselves their own task. They weren't an organisation. They were just a very committed group of people who came together to answer that question. Hmm. In answering that question, they wrote the first report that Beyond Zero Emissions published, called the Zero Carbon Australia Stationary Energy Plan, that was published in 2010. Yep. Was launched by Malcolm Turnbull in the Sydney Town Hall. And it was the first crowdsourced report of its kind, and it really predated a lot of incredibly important work that followed shortly after that, where other organisations with larger budgets were able to come in and really kick the tires of that central idea that we'd proposed. You could get there in 10 years, you could do it with commercially available technology, and that when you do that, you actually create a positive benefit to the economy. That idea is now well tested, well proven, and we're talking about far more than 100% renewable energy these days. In the years since we first published that report, one of the most important things that we wrote, I think, was a report called Renewable Energy Superpower in 2015. And that there was starting to talk about 500%, 700%, 1,000% renewables. How big could our renewable energy powered grid get? And actually look at replacing not just Australia's domestic demand for renewable powered electricity and all of our energy needs, but could we actually build enough renewable energy to replace and address our export situation as well, where Australia's export economy is incredibly exposed to global markets. And as global markets and our trading partners decarbonize, we have a huge amount of our economy at risk unless we are quite diversified and powered by renewable energy.
A couple of great examples. Obviously, there's a huge amount of research that has been undertaken under the umbrella of BZE over the journey, but emblematic of the role the organisation plays in kind of expanding the terms of the debate with well-researched, well-thought-through, evidence-based argumentation. I feel like BZD sort of operates in that sort of slightly uncomfortable space 5 to 10 years ahead of where the current debate is. good on you, because that's an incredibly important role in terms of expanding the terms of the conversation that we're having around energy and carbon and that transition to a net zero economy. Is that something you're very, very conscious of in your role as CEO and as you steer the organisation forward?
Absolutely. I think I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, really, in the CEO role. I think we've had some incredible CEOs leading Beyond Zero Emissions over the years. And each time BZE has really been set the same task of what is technically possible what is absolutely necessary for our economy, for our jobs, for our communities, for our emissions, for our environmental, stewardship of the country and of the planet. What is absolutely necessary to do and technically possible today? And that's one of the most attractive things for me about working with BZE, which I did as a volunteer for the first 8 years that I knew BZE. I was trained as an engineer. I worked as an architect for 10 years. And so my involvement in BZE is I'm drawn to it because we're so pragmatic in these solutions. I'm so much less interested in a theoretical possibility that might come into place if the stars align in 20 years' time. Personally, not such an interest. What can we do today to bring down emissions, to actually set up the economy now so that we have great jobs and great opportunities for today's workforce, but also our children? That is incredibly interesting. And that's something that I really want to get on with. I think we need to do far more of that. And I hope that where BZE might have started being that voice about what the 10 or 20 year kind of horizon might have looked like, I hope that we're getting closer and closer in that, because the need to act has kind of never been bigger than it is right now. Yep. And I think that the world, that the country is moving really, really fast. Our ideas that were or are audacious, last year we wrote the Million Jobs Plan. How could you bring a million jobs into the, or job years into the economy over the next 5 calendar years and decarbonize 7 sectors? Like that's a really big idea. And already, you know, you can see a lot of incredibly important progress across some of those areas. So I really hope that we're compressing this timeframe between the audaciousness, the audacity of BZE's ideas, and then the real world implementation of these solutions.
Yeah, it's a great point, and we really need to do that because the scale of the challenge is such that the things that we can get on with and do now, we just need to get on with and do now, because there are harder challenges down the track that really require us to research and ruminate and work through deployment strategies. There's things that we can do immediately that sort of give us that time and that bandwidth in order to deal with the actual hard stuff.
That's right.
You brought up the Million Jobs Plan. I wouldn't mind just digging into that a little bit. Listeners to the podcast will be familiar with our exploration of the topic of renewables and particularly energy efficiency as stimulus. This is a theme which has had currency right around the world, really kicked off by some fantastic work that was done by the IEA and IMF in June last year. Pretty quick off the mark, I might say, Heidi, the IEA in driving that work as the scale of the economic challenge associated with the pandemic became apparent. But then you had these local efforts to do the storytelling around what that might look like. And the Energy Efficiency Council did some work in that space with some of our partners. You had some great work out of the Climate Council and, of course, BZE with the Million Jobs Plan, which got a lot of attention in terms of the public conversation around what was possible. I wonder if – I know you were involved with all of that even before you became CEO. I wonder if you could just describe the kind of the thinking that was the initial catalyst for BZE taking that on, because it strikes me that, you know, you got that out in the market relatively quickly, right? And there must have been a huge amount of work that went into pulling that report together, with the clock ticking, I assume, you know, wanting to have an impact with the budget cycles we were working with back in 2020.
That's right. We're talking today in the midst of another Melbourne lockdown, Melbourne lockdown number 5. So back in the days of Melbourne lockdown number 1.
I like how our lives are now marked in lockdowns.
All the way back to those times. If you can remember the first time we got locked down. Yep. Beyond Zero Emissions, at that point, we had finished it recently. So I'll go a little bit backwards. We've finished all of our sector-based decarbonisation plans that took us about 8 years, and we'd done this huge swathe of work. We brought out like 1 sector-based report roughly per year, looking at these deep decarbonisation pathways, commercially available technology and all that great stuff. And we'd started working on place-based implementation pieces that were working with local partners to see how you could take the great ideas, the necessary solutions that we'd identified for decarbonisation and apply them in places around Australia where the local economy and the local community is really challenged by a transition away from fossil fuels. So in March last year, as we go into lockdown one, we were gearing up to do a year of intensive work in the Hunter Valley in New South Wales. We had just hired a team member up there to lead the local engagement work, and we'd really been probably scoping that project, building up for about a year and a half. Like, this was a really major piece of work for us and incredibly important. COVID took a huge blow at that in that process and all of that work that we had set up. So when we had our first kind of bit of a war council meeting, like, what do we do? And I'm sure you had the same thing, right, at EEC. What do we do? How do we approach our role in the pandemic? And as the first whispers came out about the gas-fired recovery and the approach that we were seeing by others in Australia, Australia's leaders were looking to the gas industry to really lead us out of this recovery. And we thought, my gosh, we've got so many better solutions than that, so many better opportunities to get enormous numbers of jobs back into the economy. And that was the genesis of the Million Jobs Plan. It's a retrospective across the seven sectors, and it takes a look at where are, and kind of cherry picks, the very best, most jobs-rich opportunities across each of those sectors. So these are lined up by a couple of key criteria. We're identifying projects and initiatives where you get a lot of jobs, you get them quickly, where you can stimulate enormous private sector contribution. So this is looking for those massive uplift. We do want public support from this, but for every public dollar that goes into these projects, we want to see the private sector doing everything they can to back it in. That's where we get the five-year plan. We get 1.8 million job years. And so that to us was really important because it gives you an idea of the quantum of the opportunity, the 1.8 million job years, and you can deliver it in 5 years and split those jobs like that. You can deliver it more slowly. You could deliver it more quickly based on how many, you know, supply chain issues you might bump into. But you get a sense of like what the opportunity is for Australians, and then gives you like a flexibility in how you might deliver that outcome. Across those sectors, I think delivering better buildings, doing massive energy efficiency upgrades is around half those job opportunities. This is, I know, a shared area of interest for EEC and Beyond Zero Emissions, how we can actually get those compounding benefits from delivering energy efficiency into homes in particular. Was incredibly topical, especially in the middle of the pandemic, because having a warm home in winter and a cool home in summer, controlling your air leakage and doing all of those things that are good for energy efficiency are also really good for human health. And that was never more important than when people were trying to protect themselves from an outbreak of coronavirus, which is a respiratory disease. And also your respiratory issues are coming out of homes that are too cold in winter and too hot in summer and not well ventilated and all the rest. So this was really a solution that was of its time, gives us jobs. There's a lot of private sector opportunities that Australia has not yet set up in our market to be able to do mass deployment of energy efficiency upgrades. We're not yet there. We're not yet delivering them at the scale that we could be. Other countries have some great examples that we could apply here. And that for us was sitting there at really as the cornerstone of the Million Jobs Plan for half of those 1.8 million job years just in delivering better buildings.
It's really interesting, you know, the way the Europeans think of this. They look at the retrofit rate and, you know, the upgrades that you need to undertake in buildings over a period to 2050 and the rate. Because they've broadly got a view in Europe that you need to fix every building, if I can put it in those fairly stark terms, if they've got any hope of meeting that net zero target. What does fixing the building mean? It means improving the thermal performance, upgrading the appliances, making that fundamental unit of the energy system, which is the building, making it compliant, if I can put it that way, with a net zero economy. And that is labor intensive stuff. They're good local jobs, but it takes a lot of tradies and trucks rolling around the suburbs, rolling around our regions, fixing people's homes. And then, you know, you throw in the health benefits, and it's, if you look at the New Zealand government's Healthy Homes program that have been rolling out insulation, their analysis of that program found that for every dollar of energy savings derived from fixing people's homes, there was $99 of benefit for the health system in terms of reduced health costs, which is a pretty remarkable figure. So there's all kinds of good reasons to do this. And I feel like last year was a little bit of an inflection point in terms of the literacy in the stakeholder community around Australia, around the role energy efficiency needs to play in the climate transition. Now, we've been out here banging on about this stuff for quite some time, Heidi. And I know that, you know, people like BZE that are sort of across the data and across the, you know, the different chunks of opportunity also across it. But in terms of just it elevating as an issue and a realization of just how jobs rich it is and how relevant it is in the context of an economic recovery, we crossed an inflection point. And you saw it probably most notably in the investments that were made by the Victorian government last year, which I think I've described as the greatest hits of energy efficiency stimulus. You know, you had the public building upgrades, you had the social housing upgrades, you had the appliance upgrades for vulnerable households, you had the support for manufacturers to improve their energy efficiency. Sort of the list goes on. It was very congruent with both what sensible people were saying, you know, locally here in Australia, but also what the list of things that the IEA said, you know, would be productive for governments to invest in.
I think we're going to be just finding ourselves in furious agreement over that. Probably harks back to my previous career working as an architect. I worked on a lot of mostly public buildings, and it was my entree to BZE was, you know, getting deeply involved with BZE on our plan to retrofit every building in the country to prepare it for a zero emissions grid. And at that time in 2013, when it was published, it was the first time that an organisation had laid out what types of commercially available technology could you deploy at scale to be able to prepare our building sector for zero emissions. So this was not about getting every single building to zero emissions. It was actually about preparing for the grid integration of a zero emissions grid plus the distributed energy that's coming in on buildings and actually generated and used within the neighbourhoods and the urban environments where it's created. So that there was a fantastic experience to be able to prove up to myself that in theory, of course, it works. Like, you could actually do it. There is nothing to stop us from getting on with this. This is a opportunity on the table for ready for the taking. And so I agree with you entirely. The Victorian government has done some fantastic steps towards that. One of the other initiatives in our buildings chapter of the Million Jobs Plan was not just the retrofits of low-income homes. We wanted to see 2.5 million of those retrofits delivered in 5 years. We also wanted to build 150,000 zero emissions or net zero carbon social housing units as well. Mm-hmm. That opportunity there would, you know, not just look at addressing the energy performance of our housing stock, but also about providing really affordable living for people on low incomes. And I think too often we talk about cheap housing as a solution to a housing problem, but it's actually, we need affordable living, not just affordable rent or mortgages. And that there means that the quality of the building really becomes, like you say, right at the heart of issues for organisations like ACOS and others, where this is a social issue as well as an energy issue, as well as a health issue. This is a great Venn diagram of opportunity right here. And we need to make sure that what we're doing today draws on all of what we know from all of those sectors to make sure that we're approaching the delivery of these programs in the best and most affordable, most efficient way.
First Fuel is brought to you by the Energy Efficiency Council, a not-for-profit membership association for businesses, universities, governments and NGOs. The Council's mission is to unlock the potential of energy efficiency to deliver healthy, comfortable buildings, productive, competitive businesses, and an affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy system for Australia. To find out how your organisation can get involved, visit eec.org.au/membership.
we've talked a lot about building so far, but BZD's done an awful lot of work sort of thinking about how we support the industrial sector here in Australia on a journey towards emission reduction and ultimately decarbonisation. There's a great deal of interest in this topic just at the minute. You've got the great work that's being carried forward by ClimateWorks Australia and Climate Kick in the emissions transition initiative. You've got a lot of government interest in this space. In New South Wales in particular has a very significant pot of funding to support large industrials in hard-to-abate sectors to do some pretty innovative stuff over the next period of time around abatement. There's various reports floating around about what the opportunities are. BZD's obviously been thinking through that space over the last decade or so. My question, though, is sort of almost dividing up where the opportunities lie between, you know, things that are ready to go now or almost ready to go, like, you know, we can get to them in the next 3 to 5 years, versus things that are genuinely hard, and even, you know, the experts within BZA are sort of scratching their heads and saying, oh, you know, this requires a bit of work and we don't quite have the solution pinned down. Can you sort of broadly characterise what's in both those categories? Noting that this is a very unfair question because there's incredible diversity in Australia's industrial space. But maybe if we think about manufacturing, for example, just to give it a little bit of focus, Heidi.
Look, I'd love to talk about this. This is one of my favourite topics of the moment. BZD's role in this space, we consider our first and foremost voice to be about technical possibility.
Yep.
So I think that very often what we hear is justifications around the economic viability or particular technologies not actually being at that deployment point in there, or that maturity where they're really ready to go for mass deployment today and you could buy them really cheaply. So some technologies are still riding a cost curve. What's critical to understand about that is that the more that you commit to something and the more certain that policy environment is, the quicker those cost curves are ridden and the steeper they come down to levels where they are actually deployable. So we'll start with, I'll reframe the question to be one that I want to answer, which is...
Biomed.
Technical. Which electric manufacturing technologies do we want to see in action in Australia today?
Hmm.
And that is industrial heat pumps, it's electromagnetic heating, it's electric furnaces, it's heat storage, and it's renewable hydrogen for feedstock and for specific industrial processes. So in 2018, Michael Lord was our head of research at the time, and he started this journey about looking at our industrial sector and where the biggest opportunities were. He wrote a report called Electrifying Industry that was published in 2018, and he did 10 how-to guides which talked about deploying those technologies that I've listed and talked about how those technologies could be used to make everyday products in Australia, things that Australia makes quite a lot of. And because it's fun, I'll list some of them so you can have a bit of a hook to listeners to go and check them out, because it's great to have a little how-to guide, especially if you're running a factory, if you want to petition someone in your local community to run their factory a bit greener. This is everything from electrifying prepared meals, electrifying milk powder. You can dry paper and make paper. You can make bricks in a brick microwave. Now, that's a pet project of mine. If anyone listening wants to talk about microwaving bricks on an industrial scale, please do get in touch. I love talking about that. Electrifying plastics, glass, steel, electrifying ammonia and hydrogen, and how to electrify beer. And if that doesn't get you downloading the How Electrifying Industry report from the BZE website, I don't know what will. We're Australians, we love our beer, and you can make it with 100% renewable energy.
I can see why they appointed you CEO, Heidi. Well done.
It's hard not to love a report like this. It's a fantastic opportunity. And one of the best hooks for this was it was my journey to becoming a staff member and then eventually into this role was the chance to talk with Michael and with the CEO at the time, Vanessa Petrie, about what could I do to help the BZE at the point that we were at in 2018. And the opportunity was for me to help bring the electrifying industry report to life. So I spent about 12 months part-time, but going out and visiting factories around Victoria, around New South Wales, to find out like what are the real barriers and challenges to deploying those, my top five, you know, technologies that Michael has written up in his report. And that really, to me, is the key difference between how BZE does its work. So we're really connected, our researchers really connected to people who are implementing these technologies. And then we do the legwork to go out and actually meet with people, go and walk the factory floor, ask about why does that gas furnace or that gas preheating device, this giant roaring piece of like, you know, industrial machinery, why couldn't that be replaced with an electric alternative? What is the heat points that are stopping you, or is it the contracting, or how does that actually work? And then to start to pair up that on the ground experience that people are having, why aren't more of these technologies being deployed in Australian factories? Because you need to compare that with the opportunities that are available in the private market, but also in government incentive schemes to be able to help manufacturers make that transition. And there's a lot of gaps there still. Like, while there's fantastic work happening, and I think actually more and more every day, there is a lot more opportunity to deploy electric technologies into factories to be able to make those factories more efficient and prepare them for a renewable energy grid. There are still some really critical gaps. And partly some of these problems are that the capital cost of preparing for an all-electric grid, replacing some of those foundation technologies, that is still prohibitive for a lot of manufacturers. So it's that exploration that we did around challenges to deployment that really led us and set the foundation for us to really dig in and explore a precinct approach to providing part of the backbone infrastructure that you need for manufacturing regions to be able to transition as a region instead of just individually. When one factory goes on this journey alone, you'll find them having to pay for transmission line upgrades or new connections back to, you know, the grid in particular locations. You'll find them having to, you know, early retirement of particular gas products and gas connections that they've set up. It's all very practical stuff, right? None of this is new. None of this is rocket science. But it's actually, when you put it all together, you can see that there are some major opportunities here for taking a collective approach, taking a precinct-based approach to the infrastructure design to accelerate the deployment of those existing technologies that can be used to get Australia's manufacturing ready for a zero emissions grid and actually making zero emissions products and services ready for the world as well as Australia. This is a golden opportunity.
So you've led us neatly into the renewable energy industrial precincts, and you've started to answer a question, because I haven't had the opportunity to dive into this into this work that you've been doing it. But one of my questions was, are we talking about greenfield sites or brownfield sites? And it sounds like this is very much not just talking about, you know, building new industrial sites, which is in many senses important but relatively easy compared to actually transitioning the manufacturing base that already exists. Is that right, Heidi?
That's absolutely right. So when we look at transitioning our existing manufacturing base, so we want to protect existing jobs, we want to protect existing products and supply chains. When we do that, building this backbone infrastructure, it's going to get more and more efficient the larger scale you go. So I think we look at the two things here. We've got a growing market for zero emissions products and services. We've got existing capacity and existing production facilities in, like, concentrated in regions around Australia. We're working in the Hunter and in Central Queensland and Gladstone as of today. So those two regions we're looking at, you've already got the skills base. You've got a lot of factories already there. You've got a lot of existing potential that can actually be scaled. It's relevant for a zero emissions economy. It's going to have a strong future demand for battery making, for making steel, but making it with renewable energy, for transitioning a whole lot of our industrial feedstocks like ammonia and hydrogen and scaling up that production and using those products even domestically as well as exporting. All of these opportunities are here when we look at moving existing factories, existing businesses, it's cheaper and more effective if we plan to expand that as well. So it's not just the brownfield sites, but it's actually looking at the areas around them that can be connected in. So we, when we talk precincts, we are talking physical precincts. We want to see subsets where we've got shared, like embedded networks for green electricity. We might have embedded hydrogen networks. We might be able to share heat, industrial heat processes, which apparently everyone says is very confusing and I shouldn't talk about very much, but I think this is the audience to care about industrial heat, shared industrial heat systems. So it's the same way that we deliver and share resources in our urban environments. We create ring mains and embedded networks and all the same stuff at an industrial scale. And that opportunity, and to actually create a policy environment where expanding, supporting existing manufacturers and expanding what's happening there, that certainty and designing and building our manufacturing infrastructure for that scale makes the whole lot more efficient, more effective and faster and cheaper to build. So it's the more work we do in this space, I only get more excited. So imagine what I'm going to be like when you come back and talk to me about, like, I'm just working in two precinct locations at the moment. We've got 14 around the country. So come back, invite me back and we'll talk about what's happening in other states in future.
I did note your comments in some of the media around the work that was released around joining the dots between some different sort of streams of government policy. So we've got the technology roadmap and the low emission technology statement and a clear interest from the Morrison government in driving down technology costs. Then we've got, you know, the significant effort from the government to expand Australian manufacturing. And this is an opportunity to bring those two pieces together, noting, of course, your point, which if it sailed past any of our listeners earlier in our conversation, I just want to hang a lantern on it. The way you drive down cost is by ramping up deployment, right? So you can do all the research and development you like. You can have as many pilots as you like, but it's about creating demand for a product, creating the supply chain, building the expertise among service providers to support manufacturers in this case, and installing the equipment. And so you need a very clear deployment story to do that market transformation piece. And we're effectively talking about transforming Australia's manufacturing and aligning it with this net zero future.
So the renewable energy industrial precinct piece, we think fits together and kind of is this glue drawing on, like you say, the modern manufacturing strategy, technology investment roadmap, the hydrogen roadmaps, but also the work of the state governments in renewable energy zones. Our renewable energy industrial precincts all need a renewable energy zone to link up to make sure that we're getting that demand and deployment thing happening first. We know that the to deploy more renewable energy into the market, we need some really strong demand side story and that demand side commitment for it. And we know we need to go really fast in building that renewable energy as well. So this can actually incentivize and develop those two twin markets side by side. The opportunity here for Australia is when the federal government could take a national approach to this. We've suggested and put forward in a piece of work late last year that we did in partnership with WWF Australia and their energy team. Nikki Eisen there is a fantastic collaborator. We put forward a shared piece that identified 14 locations around the country. We said, if you could take these locations as your first movers in every state and territory, except for the ACT, if every all these locations where we've got an existing workforce, we've got existing skills, and we've got this export opportunity through a port, we can make products onshore and we can push them out to the world. You could actually have a national strategy that sets us up to be a world leader in creating these products and services, in creating that national strategy. It can't be done without the partnership at every level of government, from those locations on the ground all the way up to the feds, to help this happen in a really coherent and clear way. This can help us attract private market contributions to these places. So we're talking about the work today that you've referenced that we've released talks about $35 billion of new capital investment going into just two of the 14 locations. That's the Hunter and Gladstone. They're very big locations, but that's a lot of new capital investment going in. The annual revenue, again, combined between the two locations, would be over $13 billion a year in 10 years' time. That's the uplift in those new industries. And we are just looking at new industry deployment for that. So that's some of the technologies that I was describing earlier. I encourage people to go and check out our website for the latest reports. This is the economic analysis of the renewable energy industrial precincts. That's all the money side. But most importantly, we've really got to look at the jobs. So we keep saying, oh, there's a great skills match and there's great jobs. These are jobs in trades that we're talking about. So 45,000 new ongoing jobs, with around half of them a pretty direct analysis or a pretty direct transition from the types of jobs, the types of trade work that you're doing when you're working in a fossil fuel industry, maybe working in a coal mine, working in a power station. You're actually able to do a direct translation of a lot of those jobs. So on paper, this is looking extremely strong, and we're currently engaging with a whole lot of businesses on the ground in the Hunter and in Gladstone to share this work with them and to actually co-create. Let's just get in, roll our sleeves up and design what this backbone bit of infrastructure needs to look like, not just for today, but actually to build out this 10-year opportunity and make that happen. So around 40 businesses have joined us so far. We're looking at everyone from, you know, really big steel factories to emerging industries, making thermal bricks. These businesses are all signing up to go on this journey with us. And we really need to see a clear policy setting from the federal government to help us move forward on that with confidence. And I think that the opportunity right now has kind of never been bigger and never been more of a push and a pull towards making projects like this happen.
Heidi, it's a great note to finish on. What I just want to commend BZE on is that deep engagement with particular parts of the economy, because it's one thing to put out reports that are kind of, you know, building castles out of clouds about all the wonderful things that we could be doing with all the wonderful technologies if all the stars aligned. It's another thing to roll up your sleeves and actually be working in those communities and be committed to listening to, you know, the lived experience of businesses on the ground, many of whom are very sort of on top of, you know, the risks and opportunities that they face in the next 10 years, and they want to be proactive about addressing those risks and capturing those opportunities. But they need partnerships, because this is untrodden territory. We're really at the bleeding edge of this economic transition that we're working our way through in Australia. So it's fantastic to hear that you are out there and on the ground, co-creating a sense of what that future can look like and helping people see themselves in it. Like, that's what's going to be necessary. That's the hard work that needs to be done, particularly over the next 5 to 10 years, so that we can actually drive this forward. And as you said at the start of the podcast, shorten that sort of cycle from idea to implementation, because we just need to ramp it up as we work through this next decade. So thank you for joining us on the show. Thank you for sharing some of what BZE has been up to and is going to be up to. There's obviously the BZE website's got fabulous resources. We'll also link to the reports you've mentioned in the show notes for this episode. So looking forward to staying in touch and helping out where we can.
Such a pleasure talking with you today, Luke.
That brings today's episode of First Fuel to a close. If you have comments, you can find us on Twitter. You'll find Heidi on Twitter at Heidi Lee Says, or one word, and my handle is at Luke Menzel. And to keep up to date on the latest in energy efficiency, energy management, and demand response, you can follow the Energy Efficiency Council at EECouncil. If Twitter is not your thing, you can email the team. The address is firstfuel@eec.org.au, and make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to First Fuel in your podcast app of choice. To learn more about the show, including upcoming live recordings, visit eec.org.au/podcasts. But for now, it's goodbye from us, and we'll catch you soon.